Okay, so I think we can start this evening's talk. I like the snoring meditation tonight. That was very good, huh? Really relaxed, really at ease as we... Very good, okay. So tonight's talk is going to be on Samatha and Vipassana. And these are very kind of central words in the ideas of Buddhist meditation. Samatha is usually translated as calm or peace or tranquility or anything like that. And Vipassana is often translated as insight, which perhaps is not the best translation, but anyway, that's a very common translation for Vipassana. These are two very core aspects of Buddhist meditation practice. And it's very good to have an idea what these things mean, what they're all about. And this is one of the reasons why I want to talk about this tonight. But another reason is that very often how I choose a topic for a talk here at Dhammadokka is usually just things that happen in ordinary life, right? Something happens and it reminds you that something needs to be discussed and talked about. And one of the things that happens to me fairly regularly, perhaps, or at least occasionally, is that people call Bodhinyana Monastery and they say, do you teach Vipassana meditation, right? It's quite interesting. They call Bodhinyana Monastery, do you teach Vipassana meditation? And I'm not sure what to say when they ask that question. So what I often say, Vipassana meditation is an insight meditation, right? And often not quite sure what to say, because Vipassana meditation, the way it is normally taught, is a bit different from how Ajahn Brahm teaches meditation at Bodhinyana. So I say, in one way we teach Vipassana meditation, in another way perhaps not. Or I say, we teach Buddhist meditation, teach the meditation of the Buddha, or we teach real meditation. I say, something like that. I don't don't want to be too confronting, obviously, when somebody is new to the Dhamma and new to meditation practice. But what I really want to say to people when they ask, do you teach Vipassana meditation? What I really want to say is that, well, the Buddha didn't really teach Vipassana meditation. That's what I want to say, because that is the truth. The Buddha doesn't say anywhere, he doesn't talk about Vipassana meditation. He talks about Vipassana, insight, on the one hand, he does talk about that, and he talks about meditation, but he never actually joins those two terms together into Vipassana meditation. That is, I think, a very important thing to understand. The Buddha doesn't actually use those terms, and of course, when he doesn't use those terms, then the whole thing kind of becomes much more interesting. What then is Vipassana? How does it work? How does it function together with Samatha, etc.? These are some of the issues that I want to talk about. But you can see why people are so interested in Vipassana meditation, right? Insight meditation is something, on the surface of it, something very powerful, right? Who doesn't want insight? Insight means wisdom, it means understanding, it means having clarity about things, it means knowing your own body and mind, understanding the universe, understanding how things work, right? It's very attractive. When I hear the word insight meditation, I sort of, the initial response is, good, this is exactly what I would want for my life, meditation that leads to all these positive qualities, which are, of course, many of them are very essential on the Buddhist path. That's really good marketing, right? Insight meditation, very powerful marketing. And that's why, I think, one of the reasons why it has taken off. But again, it is problematic because the Buddha never actually used this terminology, insight meditation. It's also problematic for another reason. And that is when you talk about insight meditation, what you are basically doing is that you are splitting apart these two ideas, samatha on the one hand and vipassana on the other, calm on the one hand and insight on the other. By saying insight meditation, you are saying that there is something else called calm meditation, right? You're dividing these things apart. And by emphasizing the insight meditation, you are basically saying that perhaps the calm meditation isn't so important, right? Why would you emphasize the insight meditation unless, how can we emphasize that without also at the same time saying that the calm meditation is not so important? The very fact that you emphasize one thing implies something about the other. And this is another reason why I think it is a bit unfortunate to actually talk about insight meditation in this way, because it implies a certain value judgment of what really matters on the Buddhist path. I want to talk a little bit, first of all, before I talk about how vipassana actually comes about. If the Buddha doesn't use vipassana meditation, insight meditation, then what does he actually talk about? How do we get insight if insight meditation doesn't actually exist in the suttas? But before I talk about that, I want to talk a little bit about the ideas of samatha and vipassana, calm and insight. What are they? What do they actually mean? So calm, I'm sure it's pretty obvious what it means, right? You come here on a Friday night, you sit down, you close your eyes, and you kind of, you know, relax and you feel easy. And hopefully, at least some of you feel a bit more calm at the end of the half an hour. It doesn't always work, right? Sometimes, perhaps, you don't feel more calm. But generally speaking, if you do a bit of meditation practice, wherever that is, you feel more calm afterwards, right? So what does that mean? What does it mean that you feel more calm? It just means, you know, you feel more, the mind is perhaps a bit less restless, right? There's less desires there, perhaps. There's less defilements in the mind. And you feel more relaxed. You feel more at ease. So it's a very positive experience, right? This idea of samatha is a very beautiful thing. To feel calm is far preferable to feeling agitated or restless and this and all this other kind of stuff. But the interesting thing, of course, is that that little bit of calm that you feel maybe coming here on a Friday night, that is only the beginning of this beautiful journey in Buddhism, where the degree of calm that you can have can be taken, you know, stage by stage, more and more profound, until you feel a senses of peace and senses of calm that you didn't have any idea could even exist in this world. Kind of sense of profundity about this calm, sense of profundity about where meditation can actually take you. You become so incredibly peaceful. The whole world becomes still. The whole world becomes quiet. And there's something very, very powerful and very beautiful about that kind of calm. So the idea of calm is a relative thing, right? It's something, you think that you are calm after meditating a bit, and then you become more calm and you look back and think, jeepers, I wasn't calm at all. I was actually quite restless. And then you become even more calm and think back to the previous one. You think, no, that actually wasn't very calm either, right? So you go stage by stage, and this is how you start to get a perspective on life. As your meditation becomes more profound and you look back, you start to get some kind of perspective. The more peaceful you are, the more you understand what, you know, what suffering is, what life is all about, all these kind of issues. And then eventually you take it to this very very, very high and profound stage. So it's a very beautiful thing, this idea of calm. And you have some idea what it means, but you only have a very limited glimpse of what calm actually means in this world. So that is the calm side of things. The other side of this pair, samatha vipassana, is vipassana, and is often translated as insight. Now, the first question is, how good a translation is insight for the word vipassana? And in my experience, having read a lot of the word of the Buddha, I think perhaps a better translation might be something like clear seeing, right? You're seeing things clearly, you have a sense of clarity in your mind. Another way that it can be translated is as discernment, right? Discernment is also about having clarity of things, being clear about what is going on. And these are actually very, in my opinion, perhaps better translation than insight. Insight usually means like, wow, now I understand, right? It's a moment when you actually grasp something that you didn't grasp before. Whereas clear seeing is something that you can have at any time. It hasn't got anything to do with a particular moment. It is something you can have at any time. Right now, you can see things relatively clearly, more or less clearly. So this is the first thing. I think this type of this word is probably better regarded as clear seeing. So what does it mean in practice? I just talked about what calm means in practice. You sit down, you feel more relaxed, you feel more at ease. So what about this clear seeing in practice? And again, when you sit here, again, after half an hour, hopefully you have a little bit more vipassana than you had before. So what does it mean? It means that you, because you are more calm, because you are more peaceful, you can see yourself more clearly. You can look inside of yourself. You can see your mind states. Instead of the mind just rushing along from one thing to another, from one kind of idea to another idea, from one mental state to another one, you can see things. You can see things arise. You can see things pass away. You can see the defilements, the desire arising in the mind. And you can see it disappearing again. And you can actually do something about what is going on in your mind because you are seeing what is happening inside of you. And this is the basic meaning of vipassana, this ability to be aware of what is happening, what is going on inside of you. And this is a very important part of the whole spiritual path. The more you are, the more awareness you have of what is going on in your mind, the more ability you have to actually do something about your life, do something about yourself, change your perceptions, change the way you think, and then guide your life in a new direction towards more wholesome states, toward more states that produce happiness in your life rather than things that produce suffering. So this is how you start to understand. It becomes more and more refined, right? And then again, the deeper the calm is, the deeper the meditation is, the more clarity you have, the more clear seeing you have, the more discernment you have, the more you can see inside of yourself, you can see the defilements, see what's going on. Not only do you see the defilements, but you see the causality. This idea of causality is so important in Buddhism. Why is it that you are thinking in a certain way? Why is it that you're perceiving things in a certain way? And you can see how things are built up in causal layers. One condition leading to another result, and that result in turn becoming a condition or cause for something else, and things kind of moving on. And when you understand the structure of your experience, in other words, structure in the sense of cause and result, you can do something about it, right? This is the whole point of understanding causality, is that you can actually do something about the causes, and then that leads to different results. And you can see this, right? This is what vipassana is all about. This clarity, understanding cause and result, understanding the defilements of the mind, understanding not only the defilements, understanding the good qualities of mind, what they are, how they arise, what causes them to appear. So when you do your metta meditation, right, you sit down, you say, may all beings be happy and well, and you know why that perception, that beautiful feeling arises inside of you. You can see from your own experience that it arises inside of you because you're seeing the goodness, you're seeing the positive qualities in the people around you, whoever that is. So this is vipassana, right? Very powerful again, very beautiful. And it can be taken to very, very high states on the path of meditation. We have incredible clarity and you can see things in minute details, what is happening inside of you. So again, very, very useful. Can be taken to a very high stage. And again, it's relative, right? It goes stage by stage until it reaches this very, very high and powerful level. So that is a rough idea what samatha and vipassana mean. Calm on the one hand, clear seeing or discernment on the other hand. These are the two things that we are talking about tonight. So if then there is no such thing as vipassana meditation in the suttas, if that is more of like a modern concept and a modern idea, then what is it that gives rise to this clear seeing, right? Everybody would like to see clearly. Everybody would like to have discernment in their life. So how is it? How can we actually give rise to these things if there is no real such thing as vipassana meditation? Remember, there is vipassana, there is meditation. It's just this compound which isn't found in the suttas. So what is it? And what it is that gives rise to this, and you... this will not come to you as a great surprise, but that is your purity, as your purity of your heart, your purity of your mind, the purity of your person. That is what gives rise to vipassana. The more pure you are, the more pure your mind is, the less defilements you have in your heart, the more ability you have to see things according to reality, to see things clearly, how they actually work. So why is that? Why is it that a lack of defilements and a purity inside of you is what gives rise to clear seeing? How does that actually work? And you will notice that whenever you have a desire in life, a desire looking at something, it's almost as if you have a vested interest in that thing that you desire. You're looking at this thing in a certain way, right? You're seeing the beautiful aspect of something. You have decided on looking at this thing in a particular way. And that is why you get desire for things of the world. But looking at something in a particular way is a biased way of looking at the world, right? You have a vested interest in this thing. And because it is a biased way of looking at things, this is the opposite of clear seeing. It's not a detached thing. It's not something where you stand back and you're just watching the world for what it actually is. It is a biased way of looking at the world. How does that bias actually arise? Why is it that you crave for things in life? Why is it that this craving arises in the first place? And very often it arises from our habits, from our views, how we have learned to look at the world. And very often our habits and our views, they are things that have come with us from when we were children. We were brought up in a certain way, in a certain culture, and we have acquired certain habits. Sometimes our habits go into a past life, right? They come from the way into the past. We don't even know where some of these habits and views come from. They go way into the past. So if you have been, born into a certain culture, I was born in Norway, right? So if you're born in Norway, it means you like certain foods, right? Not like Norwegian foods. And I think some of these foods are great, right? But if you saw some of those foods that I think are great, you would think disgusting. How can you eat that stuff? Rotten fish and all these kind of things that we have that are really, really nice, in my opinion. You would say it's terrible. Right? But this is, again, it's just cultural conditioning. Or in any culture you go to, it's the same problem. You tend to like the food, When the people who were born in Sri Lanka come to the monastery, they usually bring Sri Lankan food, right? You get dal and you get that kind of thing, right? Or the people with a Chinese background, they sometimes bring Chinese food. So people tend to, we are conditioned by our background in this way. So what we like in this world, what we crave for, is conditioned. We have certain views about things, and that then leads to certain craving. So it's all biased, right? We are completely biased about the things in the world. There's nothing that is really, there's no real seeing clearly. It's just a bias that is coming through. And part of that bias, sometimes it's just astonishing to me how powerful this bias can be. You think about your views about the world, right? How we look at the world. Often we have kind of political leanings, right? We are kind of leaning to the left or leaning to the right or in the middle or whatever. And we are absolutely sure this is the right way of looking at the world. We are right. Everybody else is wrong, right? And if you didn't think that way, you wouldn't have that view. So you have to think that way in a sense. But when you actually look at this from a Buddhist point of view, that view which you have, if it's a political view, if it's a view about religion, right, if it's a view about anything in life, it is all conditioned. It is all comes through our upbringing and from the past. We think that we are being rational beings. We think that we are seeing in this way because it makes sense, right? But the vast majority of time, it's just a matter of conditioning. And you can see that. Sometimes people's view is they flip over, right? They are on one side of the political spectrum, and after a few years, they're on the opposite side. What happened? Well, I was wrong before. Now I'm right, right? That's what happens. Or you go from one religion to another one. Or you go from not believing in rebirth to believing in rebirth, right? I've seen this with so many people. Now, rebirth is nonsense. That's a rational point of view, that rebirth cannot possibly be true. And then after a few years, they change their mind. And actually, rebirth is fully acceptable suddenly. So what is the difference? Which one is the rational view and which one is the irrational one? And the reality is that neither one is probably rational. Both of them are just conditioned into existence. We have a view because of the conditioning around us. That is what makes that view possible. And when you see that, you don't take those views quite as seriously as you did before, and you become more flexible about these things. But anyway, my point here is that craving is a problem. Craving is inherently biased. And then, as you crave things, you acquire things in life, you acquire relationships, friendships, possessions, all these kind of things. And as a consequence of all these acquisitions in life, you get attachments, right? And attachments also are inherently biased. If you have a child or you have a family member, you care about how they behave, right? You care about how they act. You care about whether they are well or not. And this is the bias of attachment. We cannot see clearly. Often you are upset if your child behaves badly in front of other people, or your parents behave badly in front of other people, whatever it is. You feel upset because it is so close to you. You are attached to them. It's as if they are part of you in a very real sense. So you have a vested interest in how they behave. It's not unbiased. It's a highly biased kind of situation. So in all of this, the point I'm trying to get to here is that our views, and especially desire, the defilements of the mind, desire, attachment, all these kind of things, they give us a bias. You cannot possibly see things clearly when you have attachments and desires. So what that means is that this is why a vipassana becomes impossible and why purity of mind is so important. And it's exactly the same thing with anger, right? When you're angry, you think, yeah, I've got to tell them off, I've got to do this, I've got to kind of give them a piece of my mind, right? And then afterwards, you feel foolish. Why did I actually do that? And again, you realize that the anger was a kind of bias. It biased you in the wrong direction. You did something that you don't really believe in. And as a consequence, you feel bad about it afterwards. So this is why, again, vipassana, clear seeing, can only happen in a pure mind. And the more you reduce those defilements of the mind, and the more you give rise to all the beautiful qualities of mind, the kindness, the compassion, the more clarity you have, the more you see the world in the real way, and the more you're able to have vipassana. This is what drives vipassana, purity of mind. So it tells us something about the incredible power, the incredible importance of purity, of lack of defilements, on building up the good qualities on the Buddhist path. This is where vipassana, clarity, comes from. So this is very interesting, in my opinion. And the Buddha talks about this, of course, in many places in the suttas. But it's very fascinating because if you look at the other side of the coin, I was talking about samatha before, calm, you will recognize, if you have been doing some meditation in your life, you recognize that that samatha, that calm, the peace, the tranquility, where does that come from? That too comes from purity, right? What is it that takes you away from peace? What is it that takes you away from tranquility? It is often desires. You desire something. You think about the past. You think about the future. You are perhaps upset about something, right? You're feeling restless or agitated. All of these things go together. So calm also comes from purity of mind. So calm and vipassana come from the same source. They both come from purity. And they both have the same origin on the Buddhist path. That's quite interesting, isn't it? And it is very interesting because one of the things that you see when you read the discourses of the Buddha is that calm and clarity, samatha and vipassana, they are always, almost always, not always, but very often, conjoined as a pair. They go together. They're not separated out as separate things, but they always go together. And now you can start to appreciate why that is the case. It is the case because they originate from the same source. They both originate from purity of the heart and the arising of the good qualities instead. So this then is is how these things come into existence. They come into existence from the purity of the heart. And that has, of course, some tremendous consequences, right? If they both come into existence from the purity of the heart, it is that purity that we have to focus on in our lives. How do we reduce the defilements of the mind? How do we become more pure as individuals? And as you do that, both of these things will arise together. So how do we become more pure? It's quite interesting, isn't it? It's nice to have a pure heart. It's nice to, because you feel happy when you have a pure heart. So how do we do that? And of course, one of the obvious ways of arriving at that purity, so we can get the vipassana and the samatha. Of course, the first part is just being kind, right? Being virtuous. And kindness and virtues in Buddhism also includes the kindness of the mind. So developing a bit of loving kindness, developing compassion, developing all the good qualities is a very important part of this thing here. And remember this, right? This is the foundation stone for any kind of meditation practice, any kind of Buddhist practice. Kindness, right? Goodness of heart, doing what is right, doing what is good, avoiding the bad things. It is so important. You see it again and again in the discourses of the Buddha. It is just absolutely such an important foundation stone. So please, don't forget that. And if you remember that, you will give it priority as you do your Buddhist practice. In everyday life, if you give it priority, it means you don't forget it so easily. And sometimes I hear some marvelous stories about the kindness of the Buddhists in our community. Not only the Buddhist people who are not Buddhist as well. And sometimes it's important, I think, to tell these stories. Because when you hear stories of true kindness in life, it kind of lifts you up, right? It inspires you, and it also pushes you in the right direction when you hear that. So please tell each other stories about kindness. Don't tell each other all the stories about what's on the news, right? Because that just drags you down. You feel really bad. You hear about the war here and the murder there and whatever it is. Sometimes we need to focus on the other aspect of life because there is a lot of goodness in our world. And one of the stories I heard quite recently, which I thought was a very, very beautiful story, is one of the ladies that comes to our monastery quite regularly. She is originally born in Thailand. And she told the story of when she was parked outside of Hungry Jack somewhere, in some suburb somewhere, not sure exactly where it was. And she was doing some errands. I'm not sure why she was parked right there, but she was doing some errands around in the area. And then when she came back to her car, there were all these kids, I think mostly Aboriginal kids. And they were kind of running around the car, some were hiding underneath it, they were playing around and fighting a bit and doing all these kind of things. And because they were hiding under her car, she couldn't really drive, right? She was kind of stuck because they were sitting under her car. So she didn't know what to do. She's just this little Thai lady from Thailand originally. She's not very big. She's kind of, not very strong. There wasn't all that much she could do about it. But then the inspiration came to her. And then she said to all those kids, come on, stop all this fighting. There's no need with all this fighting. I will take you into Hungry Jack's and buy you all a burger and a drink instead. So she took all this whole group of kids into Hungry Jack's, bought them all a burger and a nice drink, and they were all so happy and so pleased, right? And it's such a wonderful thing, because normally if you come out and you have a group of kids running around your car, hiding under it, right? You might get upset. I'm busy. I've got to get out of here. Get going. But instead of thinking like that, she turned the situation around. What can I do to make a nice contribution here? And that is exactly what she did. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing it is that we have people like that in our community. And then I realized, actually, there are lots of these things going on around, whether it's in Perth or in the rest of Australia or around the world. There are a lot of good-hearted people around. And sometimes all we have to do is focus on that kindness. And then it lifts you up. And it certainly made me feel so happy when I heard that. What a wonderful thing it is that people do such things. Another story that I also heard recently, this was one of the monks in our monastery. This monk had been trying to get his new passport, right? And he was going back and forth to the post office, and he was having a very hard time for some reason to get his passport. And then eventually everything was kind of right, but then he was going to give them a check, right, for the amount of money. And so he gave him this check, and the guy behind it, no, sorry, we can't accept checks. So again, he was stuck, right? And then the man behind the counter, this is just an ordinary Australian man, right? He's not a Buddhist. He doesn't have an understanding of the Buddhist teachings or anything like that. Just an ordinary guy standing behind the counter. What he said to him, he said, well, I will pay for you with my own money and you can reimburse me later on. Right? $250 or something. It's a large amount of money. It's not just pocket money. I will reimburse you. I will pay for you for this whole thing here. And you can reimburse me later on. He didn't know whether he would ever see this monk again in the rest of his life, right? He might as well have given that money away here. Because no idea whether he ever would get that money back. But of course he did. Because as a monastic, you're trying your very best to be honest about these kind of things. But again, a beautiful story about what ordinary people do in ordinary, transactions of life. And as a Buddhist monk, I find myself so often on the receiving end of kindness, not just from the Buddhist community, but also from the rest of the Australian community. You go out and you are on a shopping trip or something, you have to buy some requisites for the monastery, and people say, oh, you're a Buddhist monk, oh, you don't have to pay, it's free for you. Right? Isn't that wonderful? Or people say, I'm going to take something to the monastery. Okay, you only have to pay half price because you're taking it to the monastery. And these things are things I hear all the time. And it's such an uplifting thing that there is so much kindness and generosity in our world. So my point here is just that, this is what we have to be doing. This is the kind of purity I'm talking about. This is the kindness where we go out of our way to be somebody who lifts society up, who brings society forward, also bring ourselves forward instead of bringing things down. And in that way, we are making everybody else happy. And of course, we are creating so much purity and so much happiness for ourselves at the same time. So this is one of the things that we should be doing, of course, is all the virtue, all the kindness, all the goodness that we can, as we possibly can in our life. But of course, there is also meditation practice, right? Ordinary meditation practice. And as long, remember the point of meditation practice, because this is about purity, remember why you are meditating. And the why you are meditating is to reduce the hindrances, reduce the defilements, and give rise to the positive states, right? If that is what meditation is doing, if it reduces the bad states and it gives rise to the good states, then you know that you're moving towards vipassana, clear seeing, and samatha, calm. So that is what your meditation should be doing. It doesn't matter so much what you do. It doesn't matter whether you watch the breath, whether you do loving kindness meditation, whether you're just sitting down and enjoying the peace, whether you are contemplating a certain subject. All of that is really quite irrelevant. What matters is that you are purifying yourself. And this is really the golden rule for meditation practice. Don't just sit down, I'm doing this method, this is my method. Don't think like that. Think, how can I purify myself? Because it's only through that purification that these things, samatha and vipassana, actually will come into being. But I will give you some brief examples of some exercises, contemplation exercises, that I find are very useful in my life. And these are specific themes of contemplation that the Buddha himself recommends that everybody should do, right? He says specifically it should be done by women, by men, by lay people, and by monastics. So this is something that should be done by everybody. So for that reason, very useful. And these are like broad contemplations that give rise to very broad-ranging results. And one of the main things they do is to reduce the defilements, bring up positive states of mind. So what are these five contemplations in brief? I'm not going to talk about them in depth tonight because time, as usually, goes very fast on these Friday night talks. But the first one that the Buddha talks about is the contemplation of old age, right? Remembering that we're going to get old. Remembering that if we are already a little bit old, we're going to get older. Remembering that if we're already old, we're going to get very old later on, right? So this, just reminding yourself that if you are young now, if you think of yourself as a youth, the flip side of the coin is old age. The very word youth implies old age, right? It can only exist in kind of in conjunction with old age, because they are two sides of the same coin. So remember that. Remember that the old age is already part of you. It's already there. If you are young, you will have to get old sometime in the future. And these things are, it may sound very obvious, right? Of course I'm going to get old, but it very often we forget about these things. And because we forget about these things, we tend often to do things in life that we'd rather wish that we hadn't done afterwards. So very simple contemplation, you're going to get old. You are going to get sick, right? Same kind of thing again. Sickness is part of health. Health and sickness kind of revolve around each other. If you have one, you will also have to have the other one. And this is why, you know, the way Ajahn Brahm always likes to tease, he always says that when you go to the doctor, you say to the doctor, you should not say to the doctor, I'm sick again today. Doctor, or no, something is wrong with me, I'm sick. Doctor, I'm sick, something is right with me today. That's what you should say when you go to the doctor. And that is the understanding that sickness and health are opposite sides of the coin. You don't get carried away if you feel very healthy and strong. You don't get carried away by that. But you remind yourself how very easily everything can be turned in the other direction, and then you have the problem. And then the most powerful of these reflections is perhaps the reflection of death, right? You're going to die. Life is very limited. Death can often happen at any time. You can walk out of the center here tonight. Some crazy driver can mow you down on the pavement outside, right? And that's it. Finito. Game over. This can happen so fast. And one of the important things about death contemplation, we often think, yeah, I know I'm going to die. But the point is to make it real, right? To understand that death is always in our presence. It's always so close. It is always possible. It could happen now. It could happen today. And by making it into something that is ever-present possibility, it becomes incredibly real. And when it becomes incredibly real, it puts your whole life into this beautiful perspective. You see the beginning. You see the end. You see the end approaching. If you know that you're on your deathbed, you're about to die, how would you behave towards the people around you? It gives a very powerful perspective to how you deal with people. And if you are talking to somebody and they are saying something upsetting to you, and you remember, I could die, I may never be able to see this person again, are you going to allow yourself to be upset by them? Chances are you will not allow yourself. So it's a very, if we use correctly, the perception that you're going to die is a very beautiful thing that evens out your life, that stops you from getting upset and angry at times when you know you shouldn't really allow yourself to be upset and angry. It's a very powerful thing to keep the defilements, the impurities at bay, and keep your mind pure instead. So try that. There was a man I met many years ago, and he told me that he was a psychologist, and he told me that every time he leaves his house in the morning, he always thinks, I may not come back to my house today. And because he remembered that, I may not come back to my house, I may die on the way to work, on the way back from work or whatever, he always made sure that he said goodbye to his family in a good way, right? And this is not true, not just of our family, but it's true with everybody we meet in life. It may be the last time. And if it is the last time, what will your reaction be here? It's a very, very powerful thing. And the Buddha said, he talks about the recollection of death and the mindfulness of death again and again and again. That's something that everybody should be doing in their lives. It's a very powerful and important spiritual practice. And then we have the other thing of these five recollections is the recollection that everything that is dear and agreeable to me must become otherwise, right? Everything in life, whether it is our belongings, our relationships, our family members, our friends, everything must eventually be separated from me. And that's also a very sobering kind of reflection. It means that you, again, you don't attach so much. You don't have quite as much desire as you would otherwise have. It doesn't make you depressed. If it makes you depressed, please don't do it. Please don't think, I'm going to die, it's terrible. and you feel really bad. These things are only meant to uplift you, right? Only use them if they actually do uplift you in your daily life. Otherwise, don't do it. The idea is, if it's done correctly, it means you have a little bit less desire for the things of this life. You have a broader perspective. You're also thinking about the future, what happens after I die, right? Why cling on to all these things in life that are really just borrowed things? Everything you have in this life are borrowed requisites, right? Everything has to go when you die. So how much effort, how much clinging are you going to have to stuff you're borrowing? Are you going to cling on and attach to things that you are just borrowing? If you are renting a house, how clingy can you get to the house you're renting? If you're borrowing a requisite from somebody, how hard are you going to cling to that? Not very hard. But the reality is, everything we have are borrowed things in this world. So remember, it's borrowed stuff, right? And then you calm down, you become a bit more peaceful about these things. You don't attach as much, don't have as much craving, and you can allow it to be. Again, you purify your mind. You can have more vipassana, more clarity, clear seeing, discernment, and more calm in your life. And the last one of these five contemplations is the contemplation that everything I do in life is I'm the heir of my karma, the heir of my actions, right? Everything I do will come back to me at some stage. Whenever you act with a pure mind, whenever you act with kindness, whenever you do something good, you get happiness in return. Whenever you do something with a defiled mind, and it doesn't just mean that the mind is defiled, but you're motivated by those defilements, right? You're feeling angry and you're acting because of that anger or from that anger, then you are the heir. You will be the heir of those bad actions too. So remember that. And this is very useful. And, you know, sometimes you can feel this right away. It's not something that you have to think about as some kind of result that you get in the future life. You can feel it very often right here and right now. And one thing I would recommend you to do is to simply feel what it feels like to do the things you do. When you do something which hasn't been quite wholesome, what is the feeling that goes with that? Don't suppress that feeling. Allow it to arise. What does it feel like? And I know from my own experience that if I do something which isn't quite right, if I'm coming from some sort of defilement, perhaps I'm a bit upset about something or whatever, and I say something, sometimes you don't even have to say anything. You just think it. And what does it do? It reduces your energy level. You have less energy inside. Try to feel that. And when you feel that you are reducing your energy, it is like reducing your happiness. It's like you are feeling the instantaneous karmic effects of your actions right here, right now. If you can just feel what goodness and badness feels like in ordinary life, it's very powerful. And that shows you how if you continue acting like this and you accumulate those bad things that drain you of energy, right, that makes you feel a little bit dark, you can imagine if you accumulate a lot of that, you're not going to have very much energy at all. And that is how your future then will look. You're creating a future with lack of energy and lack of brightness and purity in your mind. So this is the problem with the karma. But then if you do a good act, how does that feel? Again, I know from my own personal experience, if I do something that is truly kind, I feel energized by it. It gives me happiness right there, right then. So do something, suddenly you get this inspiration, right? You want to do something kind to somebody. Sometimes crazy things. It doesn't have to be, you know, you can just, sometimes you just have to really take any opportunity, even though other people may think you are slightly nuts. Don't worry about that. Take the opportunity to be kind, any chance you have. And see how that works on you. And there's something very powerful. You get energized. You feel happy right there, right then, when you do an act of kindness. And what you're understanding is basically the laws of karma. Good acts lead to goodness. And then if you accumulate that kind of goodness over the long run, what you're doing is you're creating energy. You're creating brightness. You're creating a beautiful mind and a beautiful life for yourself. It is so powerful. So try to see that connection in your own life. And when you see that connection in your own life, it will motivate you again very powerfully and make it much easier to do what is right and avoid those things that are no good in life. So that is just a few reflections on how you can acquire purity in your life. And some of those reflections are perhaps a bit different from what you normally hear. But these are reflections that are quite broad, right? And they, when used broadly, they will kind of give you a guidance throughout your daily life. When you have it at the back of your mind that I could die, right? When that is at the back of your mind all the time, it means that you are much more careful in how you deal with all the situations of your life. And it becomes a very powerful way of reflecting and guiding your life in a sense. So this is how vipassana and samatha are developed. They are developed for purity. And because they are both developed in the same way, that is why the Buddha puts them together as samatha and vipassana, being a pair. They're not really different. They are two sides of the same coin. And you know that that is true, right? When you feel calm, you have more clarity. You see more clearly. When you see things more clearly, you tend to be more calm. They always go together. One can be perhaps a little bit more powerful than the other one, depending on your temperament, depending on who you are. But generally speaking, they are two aspects of the same thing, and they go together as a consequence. So, there you are. So there's a little talk on samatha and vipassana for you here. Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions here? Before I move on to those from overseas, anybody like to ask anything here?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
So, when from the Buddhist perspective, what is the right view when you are kind to people and people take advantage of that?
When you are kind to people and they take offense?
Advantage.
Okay. Take advantage of that.
Yeah.
Well, basically, if they take advantage of you, you mean like personally, of your kindness? Okay. Well, sometimes, you know, if you feel that they're taking advantage, then you lose some of the happiness from doing kind acts to them, right? It doesn't become as powerful anymore here. So if you are a kind person and you do acts of kindness, sometimes if you feel they're taking advantage, you can just withdraw a little bit. It doesn't mean that you become nasty or you do bad things, but you withdraw a little bit. You're not kind of so extrovert in your kindness towards that person. And that's okay, because you feel that it's going down in the wrong way here. It doesn't mean you become unkind. It just means that you are perhaps less forthcoming, in a sense, towards that person. That's what I would recommend in that kind of situation. Is that good enough for you? Yeah? Okay. Okay. Anything else anybody would like to comment on or ask? Yes, Alain?
Why vipassana is distorted like that now?
Why vipassana is
has been distorted coming from Burma.
So why has vipassana become distorted? I don't know if it is so much distorted. It's more like I think there's a long history behind that. There's a very, very complex history why vipassana meditation has become so powerful and become such an important kind of word in Buddhist culture generally. Lots of, I think, historical reasons. One of them, I think, is perhaps that the idea of having a more kind of scientific meditation method, right? Vipassana sounds very scientific. You follow a certain procedure, you have certain insights as a consequence, right? Whereas samatha meditation, the peaceful side of things, is often more emotional, right? You feel emotional, you feel happy, you feel elevated. And of course, we live in a society where the whole world has kind of, you know, where science obviously is very important. And traditional Buddhist societies, they were also influenced by the Western outlook and the Western scientific ideas. And when they came into contact with Western scientific ideas, they thought, wow, there's something to this, right? There's something to this science. So now we have to make sure that Buddhism kind of fits in with the scientific paradigm, right? The scientific worldview. And so vipassana that's probably one of the reasons why I think the vipassana movement became so strong. But part of it is also because I think what very often happens, and one of the big problems in Buddhism is often, well, where do we take our inspiration from? And very often, the inspiration doesn't come from the word of the Buddha. So the Buddha says there is no, it doesn't mention Vipassana meditation as such, but if you look at later commentaries, later works on Buddhism, there is more kind of Vipassana material available, and you can build up an idea of Vipassana meditation through that material. So again, it's often a question of, going back to the source, right? Where do we find our inspiration? And if you find your inspiration in the right place, I will say there isn't any kind of basis for that. So I think, again, it's about developing both samatha and vipassana. They go together. And the fault is not so much that you are developing vipassana. It's great to develop vipassana. The problem is really that they become separated. And you have samatha on the one hand, vipassana on the other. So vipassana meditation is just meditation. And it also leads to samatha. There's no distinction there. Okay. Anybody else wants to say anything? Yeah, Chris. Yeah.
Bhante, there is a certain packaging of vipassana, which was promoted by Ubha Kim and Goenka, and it was a formula, as you say, and I think what happened there, because this sort of happened back in the 50s and 60s particularly, and I think a little bit before that. But the point about that is the basic principles, or, what Vipassana was very much dumbed down, and it was simplified, and it was then packaged and made available to many, many people. Goenka spent many, many years of his life traveling all around the world, and the karmic result of that is that there are many more people who are exposed to the Dharma than there would have been compared to people who would go to the root of a tree and meet a traditional teacher. Goenka is absolutely responsible for promulgating the Buddhist ideas hugely all around the world, but there's a certain element of dumbing down associated with it. This is a package, this is a cookbook approach. And in fact, if you follow the cookbook approach, you do quite well. But it's the Vipassana that he talks about. Now, the problem is that becomes a brand name. And that brand name has that then got taken up by, the society, particularly the West. And that brand name has been promoted. And people actually take the brand name as the real thing. But the brand name is actually a very dumbed-down version of what the Buddha taught, and has been taught for thousands of years.
Sure. Yes, thank you for that. I think that's a good point. It's a brand name. It's a good brand name, right? Insight Meditation. Wow, it's a powerful brand name. That's why it's so, I think people really take it on board, But I think you're right. I think that when I look at some of the teachings of the Goenka tradition, for example, I think they're perfectly fine teachings, They teach mindfulness of breathing, they teach mindfulness of feelings in the body. But I think the problem is that, if it is a teaching which works, and for many people it does work, then it gives rise to two things, samatha and vipassana. It's not really a vipassana. From what I can see anyway, this is just my personal opinion, but from what I can see from the suttas, how the Buddha taught, they are not vipassana teachings as such. They are meditation teachings that lead to both samatha and vipassana. So yes, it is true, and sometimes when you package things like that, it does lead to a certain dumbing down, as you say, because it's packaged, precisely because some teachings are emphasized at the expense of other teachings, and it's very limited what you get. But it is often an entry point for people, right? I mean, the Goenka method is so found so extensively in, I think, almost every country of the world, and there are no doubt some exceptions, but it's so extensive everywhere that it is an entry point for people, and they start to get access to at least meditation teachings there, and then very often they move on. I have lots of people at Bodhidharma Monastery, people who are now monks, they started off with a Goenka, and they started to realize, they started to hear talks from elsewhere, actually, maybe there's more to this, right? And then they move on and do other things. And then other people find the Goenka is enough, and they stick with that. But as long as it is, as long as it gives rise to peace, calm, and the good Buddhist qualities, I think it is probably, no doubt, a good thing for the world to have those teachings. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything here? Everybody happy here? Yeah. Have you got a bit of vipassana here? Clarity of mind there. Anyway, let's see what we have here. So, the first question is from Christine from Malta. The more one meditates, the more one sees things as they really are. Sometimes that's true, perhaps not always. Yet many times during the day outside meditation practice, one falls back to bad habits. Do I need more vipassana meditation as a consequence? Anything helps, right? Anything that helps you is obviously important. And this is one of the most difficult things in the life of somebody who practices the Buddhist path, is precisely the habits. Because the habits are what gets us stuck and what are so hard to get out of. So what you need to do is you need to use some of those techniques that I, for example, suggested tonight, right? Use the death contemplation. You're going to die. Do you really have time to be angry? Do you have time to have all these desires for things that belong in this world? Why on earth would you have time to be angry if you could die at any moment? There is no time to be upset about things. There is no time to have all the desires for the things of this world that are just borrowed things anyway. So allow them to go. So these are the things that you can use to help you out. And as for meditation practice, don't think about it as vipassana meditation. Just think about it as meditation. And ask yourself, does that meditation lead to more clarity? Does it lead to more calm? Does it lead to reduction in the defilements? And if it does, then it will help you when you go back to ordinary life again. You will also have a bit more clarity. People who meditate, you don't have to meditate a lot, but make sure that whatever meditation you do, it is quality meditation that leads in the right way. And then use it. Remember, it's all about getting those defilements, those negative states, a little bit less, and the good states a bit higher. Then you're doing the right thing here. Right? So do whatever works, basically. Don't get hung up on whether it's meditation even. Don't have to do meditation, right? What matters is that you're doing things that reduce the bad qualities inside of you and increase the good ones. If meditation doesn't work, that's fine as well. Huh? Okay, I hope that helps. Anyway, so I move on to the next one. This is from Christian from Germany. Dear Ajahn, I enjoy the meditation which you teach, but after meditation, I'm always so tired and I have to sleep. Do you have an explanation for this? Because Ajahn Brahm says that meditation should be energizing, right? So you're finding the sleepy meditation. It's very, very, very common for people to feel tired during meditation practice. And especially if you live an ordinary life, right? You have lots to do, you have kids, you have family, you have work, you have business, right? And what do you expect? Especially you come here to the Dhammaloka Center on a Friday night after having spent a whole week running around, and I'm sure it is the same probably for you over there in Germany. Of course you're going to feel tired. This is very natural. But then occasionally you will have a meditation which is energized, right? And occasionally you find that the mind is energized, and you know that underneath the tiredness, once the tiredness is allowed to dissipate by sleeping properly and having the rest you require, underneath that there is that purity and there is that energy here. And that is what you, as long as you know that is there for the taking, right? That is what matters. If you never feel energy, if you never feel the energy happening in your meditation, and the reason is because the mind is not pure enough yet. There's too many defilements there. Maybe you are a little bit depressed even. Depressed people, and meditation is still very good if you have depression, but you're not really going to feel the energy in the mind, right? Depression is the opposite of energy. It's a flatness of the mind where you don't really have anything, any kind of go inside of you. So if it is that you haven't got enough purity, then what you need to do, and everybody needs to do this anyway, is to purify the foundation steps of the Buddhist path. Be more kind, be more avoid the bad things. Get out of those bad habits we're talking about just before, right? Do those random acts of kindness that are so powerful in life to random strangers all over the place, right? Sometimes it's so powerful to be kind to a stranger, because with a stranger you have no vested interest. You don't expect anything in return from a stranger, right? If you are kind to a family member or a friend, you might expect something in return. But if it is a complete stranger, it's a very pure act of kindness, because you don't expect anything back. So do all these things, and then that will also help you to energize the mind. And then when you sit down in meditation, hopefully you will feel that energy inside of you. And it all kind of comes together very nicely and very beautifully here. Okay, so those are the questions for tonight. So anybody else want to say anything? Last chance to talk? Nobody wants to talk? Good. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Satipanno bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho saṅgha